Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Mark Schwarzer, and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Phil Kitromilidis, and we're also joined by former Denmark goalkeeper Thomas Sorensen. You may have seen on the weekend, the Matildas under-20s managed to win their Asian Cup game against South Korea 2-1, coming from behind, scoring the winner in the 90th minute, despite a crazy amount of snow on the pitch. And it got me thinking about a time when I played in conditions, or even experienced conditions, of madness. And I have to say, it was my fourth and final Bundesliga game playing for Kaiserslautern away to Hansa Rostock. And I'd never, ever seen snow as much as I'd seen there in the north of Germany. And I played and I had leather studs on because they all said you have to wear leather studs. You can't wear anything else. And they were literally leather, cork kind of studs with a nail in them. And I literally played. I was like Bambi on ice. We lost 3-0 and that was my last ever Bundesliga game. So, Thomas, what was your experience? Coming from Scandinavia, you must have played a lot on snow and it mustn't have been that big a deal for you. But like I said, for me, it was crazy.
You know what? You're talking to someone who's obviously grown up in Scandinavia, who's played on a wet and windy night in Stoke and has spent 5 years in the northeast of England. Like, I can pick any night. And also, you know, looking at that Matildas game, can we just touch on that? Like, why did they collect all the snow in the middle of the pitch? Like, it was they cleared around the edges, but then piled the snow in the middle of the field.
The little bit of video footage that I saw was actually quite funny, was when the Koreans were clearing the snow, and then one of the Aussie girls just went up and kicked it all back on the spot. And then there was a bit of a scuffle. I don't know if you saw that. And the referee was like warning and that pointing fingers. So you clearly could see who wanted the game to go ahead.
Yeah, no, but the thing I remember, we had a League Cup game at Crystal Palace, and they hadn't, at that time, they didn't have any undersole heating. So we got down there, we stayed down, and we obviously wanted to play, but the pitch was rock hard, frozen. So we started the game, and we might as well have played in the car park. You know, it was horrific. And we actually had to call it off after 20 minutes and had to redo the whole travel the week after. So, it got scary and it was freezing cold. So actually, I was quite happy to get back on a bus.
Phil, what's your best experience?
I was just at a game this weekend, which was postponed for, well, it was suspended for 15 minutes because it was hailing so hard. I was at Rayo Vallecano against Cadiz in Madrid. And Madrid, it doesn't rain that much in Madrid, but it does get very cold. It's the highest capital city in Europe. So we're at some kind of elevation, 600 meters above sea level, and it does get cold. And on Saturday, it started raining and that rain turned to hail. And they had to stop the game because the hailstones were hurting the players. It was dangerous. So they all had to run off. But the fans, we were in the stands. We were trying to keep warm, jumping up and down. And I look at my son and his face is almost going blue. And he looks at me and he says, "Daddy, this is the coldest I've ever been." And I was like, "Ah, you're all right, mate. Come on, jump up and down. We'll be all right." You know, good parenting once again from me. So, the players came out after 10 minutes and we got to watch the rest of the absolutely horrific game, which finished 1-1. But yeah, hail in Madrid and I was absolutely freezing.
I saw the highlights. You probably wouldn't believe me, but I did see the highlights of that game.
Yeah, all 10 seconds of it.
No. It was about 9.5 minutes, have to be fair. And it was like a field of slushy. Like, you know, that slushy machine, yeah? It was white. And I remember one thing where Gazzaniga comes out and slides for the ball and he literally slides about 5 meters along the touchline, which was really, really quite amusing. And I know exactly how he feels. Thomas, I'm sure you do as well when that happens. And it's almost like you just can't stop and you just keep sliding and sliding and sliding. Anyway, let's move on to obviously the biggest game, certainly in the Premier League this weekend, or the most hyped up game, the Manchester Derby, Manchester City against Man United. And I'm not going to lie, I said it's just going to be such a one-sided affair. And I don't think the gap between the two clubs is any greater than it is currently this moment. Certainly not in a long, long time. I thought Man City were going to win the game 4-0, 4-1, I said. Wasn't quite like that, was it, Phil? I mean, it was a first 45 minutes was a bit of a surprise, I thought, anyway, the way Man United played.
No, I agree. I agree. And I certainly thought after, before Marcus Rashford scored, and he scores after 8 minutes, and it is so against the run of play because City start and they basically, I mean, United don't touch the ball really in the first 8 minutes. So then they get a long ball upfield, punted up, and Rashford scores this amazing goal. But I thought United did quite well in that first half within the limitations of what United are now and what Manchester City are now. I thought they were pretty well organised. I thought Man City had a lot of the ball, but didn't create that many overwhelmingly clear-cut chances. Now, there's one for Haaland, which is unbelievable that he misses. But apart from that, I don't feel like City battered them despite being ahead in all of the stats. Maybe I'm not making any sense because essentially it's City completely dominated and ending up winning 3-0. But from a United perspective, I thought there were signs for parts of the game, maybe for about 50 or 60 minutes, that actually it wasn't too bad against a side that are clearly better than them. Manchester City are clearly better than United. So for them to be able to compete and to weather the storm and restrict them a little bit, I thought that was relatively positive from a United perspective, given the limitations of the context of the two teams.
Phil, I think he's very, very positive there. I think he's definitely a sign of the times that Man City can turn up and not even be at their best and still outplay United by a mile. Yes, we can talk about Erik ten Hag came in with a plan. He sat quite deep. He had Rashford drop into midfield, so they definitely didn't defend with a striker. But Onana had a couple of good saves, I thought, in the first half. And it was really just, obviously an individual bit of quality from Rashford that got them the advantage. But other than that, I think there's more, so many question marks around United. And yes, despite a decent performance, it hasn't moved anything for me in regards to where they are at this current time.
Oh, Schwartzy, what did you think? What did you think of the game? Because obviously Thomas and I saw it a little bit differently. Maybe I'm being a little bit too positive from a United perspective. I just basically expected them to get absolutely battered. And the fact that they competed for 50 minutes, maybe that has conditioned how I viewed the game. But what did you think?
I don't know if they've competed for 50 minutes. That's the question I have. They certainly competed in that first half, like I said. And when they scored that goal, like you mentioned, there was a change in the swing in the game. And I thought, I was actually surprised at how well United were doing. And a little bit surprised at how kind of Manchester City looked all over the place a little bit. But then second half was a different thing altogether. I mean, you look at it, Man United, well, they had an XG of 0.0 created chances in the second half. That tells you everything about where they went and how they basically just hung on. And Onana, I think, was Onana's best performance in a United shirt, certainly the one that I've seen. So they were fortunate that he was on his game, because had he not been on his game, I think they could have lost the game far, far more by more goals. So they're a long, long way off. My question is, who do we think is Manchester City's most important player at the moment? Because there's these stats about Rodri, amount of games he's played in, not lost for City. But then you've got someone like Phil Foden, who is at the moment pretty much unplayable, Thomas.
You can chuck Kevin De Bruyne in there as well. I think he the impact he's made since he's come back. But I think Rodri and Foden, obviously two different roles. I think Rodri, the stats have shown that, when he's playing, Man City win most of the games. The few games he's not playing, they've actually had a significant worse record. So I actually think he's the most important player. But, in this game, Phil Foden on his own, I think he's just elevated his game season after season. I think Guardiola said it a couple of years ago, he's going to get better and better, and he has. The two goals are fantastic from, the technique of striking, but then the link-up play for the second goal, the finish, the composure, the touch, everything else, his movement. He's definitely he's the man in form. I think that's the thing right now.
It's funny that the question is being posed if it's sort of Rodri or Phil Foden, and we're not even talking about Haaland, are we? And he's the top scorer in the Premier League. But it's right that at the moment
he's missing chances.
He is. I mean, he did score yesterday, and he is still the top scorer in the Premier League. And But yeah, I mean, we're not mentioning him in this kind of conversation because of that ridiculous run of Rodri. I mean, when a player has 59 consecutive matches without losing, it's historic, and it obviously shows his importance to a side. And Phil Foden and Guardiola said yesterday, I mean, he's winning games for us now, and that was what elevates a player to be world class. And he's showing that and making the difference for Manchester City in really important games. And the run that they've been on recently, they've absolutely had to win these games, and Phil Foden has popped up with really important goals. So yeah, it's between those two. I'm not going to pick one being more important than the other, because I think they all fit into the system and are important in their ways. But I do think it's quite interesting and striking that we're not talking about Haaland in this conversation, and rightly so, because he doesn't feel like he's influencing games and being the most important player for City at the moment.
Where does it leave Erik ten Hag? There's a lot of noise now around him and about his position, the new ownership. Paul Scholes had this to say on Up to Sport after the game.
I think they've already made their mind, but I don't think he'll be there next season.
Don't you?
I don't know. But from the interviews we've heard from Sir Jim, I thought there was a little bit of negativity towards the club the last 10, 11 years, and especially the last 2 years. I don't think he's happy with what's going on. I wouldn't be surprised if they're looking for a new manager now.
Paul Scholes, I mean, look, obviously ex-United players, and out of all the ex-players of any team, they seem the most vocal, right? Manchester United ex-players. And they seem to have, I don't know, do they seem to have an influence, or they have a big voice and they seem to be in the know? I'm not really sure. I mean, obviously Gary Neville says a lot, Rio Ferdinand says a lot, and generally one way or the other it ends up happening, certainly along the line. Is there validation to what Paul Scholes is saying, Phil?
Well, I think, you know, Gary Neville and Rio Ferdinand are on TV a lot in the UK, so whatever they say gets picked up quite a lot. I think there's also just the stark contrast between that United team and those United players and what they achieved and what we're seeing now from Manchester United. So I think that makes it even harder for them to swallow what they're seeing, and probably exacerbates how vocal they are and how strong they feel about things. I almost feel sorry for Erik ten Hag, and maybe Manchester United fans will not joining me in feeling sympathy, but it is a difficult situation. But then it's he comes out with certain things that are really quite hard to get your head around. When he said, you know, absolutely not. He denied that there was a gulf in class between City and Manchester United. And to watch that game and to come out and to say, absolutely not, there is no gulf in class between these two sides, is difficult to justify. I mean, I know that he's a man that wants to underline the work that he's doing and to try and put across an idea that, you know, things aren't that bad. And last weekend he said, you know, you got to look at the bigger picture, and we suggested that the bigger picture doesn't look very good for him, and he probably knows that, and he probably knows that he's on borrowed time, and he probably knows that there's a good percentage chance that he won't be there next season, which is why I feel a little bit of sympathy for him. But at the same time, when he comes out with those kind of phrases, it's difficult to understand where he's coming from.
But there's justification, right, in the criticism, certainly at the performances on the football pitch. But then you look at the players that I must think or believe he had to have had a big say. Onana coming to the club, Lisandro Martinez. Then we look at Antony. And of course, obviously, Rasmus Højlund, who is probably the one that is, and Onana seems to be coming good. But the other ones, I mean, certainly Antony, I mean, million miles off it. So the criticism is justifiable, right, Thomas?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's, you know, he has a lot of fingers in the pie, you know, you can take like Eriksen as well. He hasn't even like featured this season as well. He was another one that came in, and a former Ajax player as well. You know, so you know, he's definitely there's a lot to blame on his plate, but he was also left a fragmented club that hasn't functioned for a lot of times. And I just feel it's always a bad sign when you get a lot of former players out, coming out, criticizing, you know, because they do have power, especially among the fans, because, yes, it was the last time United were successful. It's not helping the club. It's not helping Ten Hag. And then he's got injury issues, obviously. You know, Rashford scored a cracker, but there were still worries about, you know, his fitness. You know, he just about got through the week and got ready for the game and had the physio attending him before and after and everything else. So, you know, it's not all so easy, not easy for him. So I feel for him in some way, but that's the name of the game. And you got to deliver results. And, you know, there's a lot of question marks.
Next up is Nottingham Forest against Liverpool. Liverpool had convoluted sort of a record at Forest, and because they hadn't played first and foremost for a long, long period of time. The last year they lost there as well. This was a tricky fixture, Phil, and one that off the back of all the injuries that Liverpool have had, bringing players back, who does he bring back in, who he doesn't. It's a pretty good result in the end, isn't it?
It's a very good result. I like that we're talking about the football, by the way, first, instead of going straight into the controversy, because there was controversy about this game. But, we'll talk about the football first, which is absolutely how it should be. And yeah, this was a tricky game for Liverpool, considering the ridiculous number of players that they've got out. I mean, they started Joe Gomez in the centre of midfield, to give you an idea of the kind of team that they put out. I mean, it's still competitive, and the front three with Gakpo, you know, Elliot and Diaz, those are good players. And they were able to, in a way, find the way through. But this was a tough game. And I don't know if you agree with this suggestion constantly that this is the kind of game, this is how you need to play to win the league. You know, these last minute winners are indicative of a side that's going to win the league. And maybe that's an easy sort of cliche, because teams that win the league tend to just control matches and go out and win them and not need to rely on last minute goals, which is what Liverpool have been doing. The flip side to that is that they've had loads of players out. So while they've got this ridiculous injury list, they will take these last minute winners. But if you're consistently relying on late goals to get you over the line, maybe that isn't indicative of a side that's going to win the league. And I realise I'm contradicting myself, because I've consistently said that they are going to go and win the league. But it just feels like if you're consistently relying on this, maybe that's not the good sign that everybody says it is. I'm just rebelling against this idea. Maybe it's a little bit cliched that, oh yeah, you know, this spirit, right, fighting until the end, that's what you need to win the league. Maybe it is, but maybe it isn't.
Yeah, but it's so much to play with still, right? I mean, if you look at what Liverpool are involved in still, who they've got to play against. I mean, they've got Man City coming up on the 10th of this month, so not too far away. They've got a Europa League game in between that. They've got Man United in the FA Cup. They've got them in the league still away. So that's obviously a really tasty fixture all the time as well. The players are coming back though. Szoboszlai, Darwin Nunez, Endo are on the bench. Obviously, Darwin Nunez had a big impact on the game. So they are getting players back. I think Jurgen Klopp does an unbelievable job at managing his squad, and the young players fit in and do incredibly well. So let's get to the elephant in the room. The drop ball, the referee giving the ball to Liverpool as opposed to giving it to Nottingham Forest. Thomas, what did you think about it? And does it impact the goal?
I think, you know, that's two different things, but definitely it's a clear mistake from the referee, because the rules state, and they changed that, I think, in 2019, that, you know, to avoid any clashes with drop balls, that the team in possession was going to get the ball on restart. And when he blows the whistle, I think it's Origi who's got the ball. So, you know, it should have been given to Forrest. So there's obviously a mistake that's, you know, sometimes, you know, in the heat of the moment, and obviously you got a Liverpool player in down injured. So maybe in your mind, you're like, okay, that's their ball. But they are a refereeing team, and somebody should have made the referee aware of it. Even Nottingham Forest players, it should have been. But to actually say that the goal that happened 2 minutes after the restart is a direct consequence of that free kick, I don't quite buy that, because Nottingham Forest had two or three times where they could have cleared it. They actually, just before the cross came in, they had a massive opportunity to clear the ball and totally missed it. So it's still on their own plate. They should have still seen the game out, in my mind.
Yeah, because I think it's Callum Hudson-Odoi who actually has the ball. The referee blows a whistle. Oh, but Liverpool are clever, because Liverpool kicked the ball back to Kelleher. They kicked the ball back, and I think the referee's last thought is the ball is there. Even though he's blown the whistle beforehand, obviously the linesman's and that must have been distracted on it as well, because they've got it completely wrong. I agree with that. I think definitely 100%, there's no argument. He got it wrong. But I also agree, it's too long in between. If Liverpool got the ball, went out the other end and scored, Phil, then we'd be going, absolutely, the referee directly impacted it, and I feel really bad for Forrest. I agree totally with Thomas. They had so many chances to get rid of the ball, to deal with it. It's not that Liverpool retained the possession the whole time and Forrest didn't touch it. There were numerous opportunities for Forrest to get hold of it, but it was a mistake.
Yeah, it was. It was a human error. And we're only talking about this because Liverpool scored a 99th minute winner. You know, if there'd been no goal, then it would have just been, probably no one would even have realised what had happened. So, yeah, it's a human error. They still occur. They occur in football, even with VAR, even with assistant referees. We saw it with the Liverpool-Spurs game at North London earlier this season, when it was possibly the most egregious and ridiculous human error that we've seen, certainly in the VAR era in the Premier League. And it went against Liverpool. This time it's gone in their favour, although I do agree with you guys, like, a lot of time passed between the drop ball being given and the goal being scored. So I don't think it's a direct consequence, but it did affect the flow of the game in the last 2 minutes, because Liverpool had the ball and it ended up in the back of the net 2 minutes later. So had the referee not made that mistake, Liverpool probably would not have scored. So I guess it influences the game in a global way overall, if you look at it. But, you know, directly, it's difficult to say that it's because of the referee that Liverpool won this game. I mean, it was a good game, by the way. Overall, it was quite entertaining. Both teams had opportunities. Feel for Nottingham Forest, who had obviously, they'd conceded in the 89th minute in the FA Cup against Manchester United in midweek. They had chances to win this game as well. Their robust Greek owner Evangelos Marinakis was not very happy at the end as well. He is a man who is pretty forthright when it comes to expressing his emotions. You had Mark Clattenburg, who's now employed by Nottingham Forest, coming out as their sort of refereeing spokesman and saying that they're going to complain about this error, which just sort of added to the drama. But in terms of actual game, I thought it was a good game, and Liverpool probably on the balance of play just about maybe deserve to win it.
I mean, Darwin Nunez scored the 43rd goal that has been contributed by a substitute this season for Liverpool, which is the most by any team in any of the Europe's top five teams. That in itself tells you even more so. We all know it's a team game, but that tells you everything about Liverpool, doesn't it, Phil?
I mean, that's something that I've been talking about for the last few weeks on the pod, about Liverpool's strength in depth and the amount of contributions they've had off the bench and substitutes coming on and making a difference and scoring. And, you know, that stat tells a lot about their strength in depth and the ability to have people to come off the bench and change, which is what you need to win the title, right? You know, you need to have a strong squad and people that can come on and change the game. And also, I think I like Jurgen Klopp sort of admonishing the Nottingham Forest fans, who were singing a song about Darwin Nunez, and it's a family show, so I'm not going to say the exact words, but they were suggesting that Darwin Nunez, you're just a not very good version of Andy Carroll, which is what they were singing at him. And Jurgen Klopp says, I don't think you should sing that, because he'll come off and he'll score the goal, which is what he did. And he said, you know, Nunez was aware of the song being chanted, and he came on and made a difference. So credit to Nunez, who is having an interesting season, a very interesting season. He's the kind of player that a lot of people like watching, but then if he's part of your team, he can be immensely frustrating. But overall, he's a striker that I really like. I think he offers a lot to the team. And when he finishes his chances and improves on that finishing, he's going to be a really, really top elite level striker. And I think he's getting there. You know, we're seeing him having effects on games in recent weeks. So, yeah, don't make him angry. You won't like him when Darwin Nunez is angry. And he was obviously rebelling against that song.
This weekend, we've got the biggest game of the season coming up, which is Liverpool against Manchester City. It's live and exclusive on Optus Sport.
Bring it on.
Phil, you're not agreeing with me? What's going on?
No, I am. I was just going, oof. Which is a very Spanish noise for when something's very exciting or something's big. Yeah, oof.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely huge. And it's going to be a big indicator of where this league title might go this season. Liverpool are at home, of course. Manchester City, struggled to get going in the first 45 minutes, really, against United, Liverpool, a lot of injuries. Firstly, Thomas, how big is this in the context of the league title? And how do you see it going?
It obviously will play a part. I don't think it's not over and done with, if Liverpool win or the other way around. But it's going to be a fascinating game. As you said, it's going to be totally different from what they played this weekend. It's going to be an open game. Man City will try, to dominate like they always do. I just hope that, that we'll see a Szoboszlai, Darwin Núñez starting, potentially Endo, so we can, as well as Bobby Clark and Bradley did at the weekend, you want Liverpool at their strongest, Mo Salah, you want that, those two top teams going head to head, and let's hope we get close to that, because City seem to be coming with everything, and they have a knack for winning these games, so it'll be very interesting.
I'm so excited about this game, and it's not just me that's excited about this game. Let me tell you about the Spanish press, how excited they are about this game. They call Liverpool-Manchester City the new Clásico, which is a really big thing for them to be saying, because obviously the Clásico, it's still the biggest fixture in world football, but Liverpool against Manchester City, that's the kind of pull that it has and how attractive this fixture is around the world. I don't think you can get a better fixture in terms of sheer quality. Now, I'm obviously based in Spain and I love El Clásico and Real Madrid against Barcelona. It's got the history, it's got the pomp, it's got the grandeur, the social politics as well. It's a really faceted and nuanced rivalry which goes back decades. This doesn't, obviously. But in terms of a pure spectacle, I genuinely don't think you can get a bigger, better game than Liverpool against Manchester City. And I'm tremendously excited, because this is going to have such a big impact on the title race as well. It's not just that these are two really good teams playing each other. These are two really good teams. It's the top two in the division at the time of recording, playing each other with 11 games to go. I mean, this is massive, with a point separating them. It's a game that both teams will want to win and both teams will be desperate not to lose as well, which is set up very nicely for a draw, which Arsenal will unfortunately take advantage of, maybe. But that's the thing, it's not just these two in the title race either. You've got this third party in it, which is Arsenal, so they'll be watching on and seeing what happens. It just makes it fascinating. I'm already really excited for it.
Thomas said he doesn't think it'll decide the title. Do you think it will, Phil?
It can't decide the title yet, because there's only a point between them and there's still be 10 games to go afterwards. So it's not a title decider. But, if Liverpool win it and go 4 points clear, or if City win it and, take the lead for the first time in a very, very long time, then it's a big step. But it's not a title decider, but it is a massive, massive game. And it's the biggest game left in terms of what's going to impact the title, because these are six-pointers. I mean, we talk about six-pointers in terms of relegation, but they can also be the same in terms of the title as well. So the points that you win are the points that your opponent doesn't win as well. So not only is it City or Liverpool getting 3 points, it's the opponent dropping points as well, which makes it so important.
I don't know. For me, it just seems like if Liverpool win, it's a huge step towards potentially winning the title. Yeah, for Manchester City winning, it would only put them 2 points clear. So it's kind of like, I don't know, I just feel that with Liverpool winning, they would then get that breathing space. Liverpool, 4 points makes a big difference at this stage of the season. So on paper, it should be an amazing game. We have seen in the past games where it's not been particularly great because they've just nullified each other. I'd like to think this is going to be an absolute classic, and without saying it's going to be El Clásico, but it'll be a classic, hopefully.
A new classic,
exactly. Guys, it's 100 days until the Euros begin, which also is live and exclusive in Optus Sport. There's one player, though, that surely, I mean, I'll take your Harry Kane's out of the equation and so forth, but there's one player that I think surely has to be on that plane, and that is Ollie Watkins. Thomas, his form is unbelievable. 27 games, your old club. He scored 16 goals and has 10 assists. Scored two on the weekend. Surely he has to be next to Harry Kane on that plane.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think what Emery has done with Watkins, not just from a confidence standpoint, but also with his movement. I think, you can see that he's elevated his game you know, in that direction, you know, constantly like trying to find, you know, where can he be dangerous? Where can I get shots from? And he offers something different than Harry Kane. You know, Harry Kane, you know, a little bit slower, a little bit more towards the ball. I love the directness of Ollie Watkins. Can they play together? I don't think Southgate maybe wants to do that, but, you know, he'll be a fantastic player to have off the bench. And yeah, I agree with you. He definitely has to be on that plane.
I think he's definitely in the squad, isn't he? He's not in the starting 11. I mean, he's not going to take Harry Kane's spot. And I think we're going to see England with a front three and Foden and Saka either side of Harry Kane, maybe Bellingham just behind them. And there isn't a space for Ollie Watkins there, is there? Or maybe you could play him on one of the flanks, but I don't think that's his best position. I don't think he'd be more effective than either of the other two there. So, but as a squad player and as someone who could potentially replace Kane if needed, or you throw him on if you need a goal and play him with Kane, then certainly. And the development of his overall play as well has been quite intriguing to watch, because he's always been a goal scorer and he scored goals wherever he's gone, in, you know, lower leagues with Exeter. He's scored, I think he's in 7 or 8 consecutive seasons in double figures for league goals. Wherever he's gone, he's scored goals. But he's the top English scorer in the Premier League this season, and that is something that an English manager can't ignore. And his link-up play has improved drastically, his intelligence, his movement. So yeah, there isn't really anyone that can replace Harry Kane because he's such a unique striker. But I don't think Ollie Watkins is far off being a pretty good plan B in terms of Kane. So yeah, I think he's got to be on the plane, certainly.
He's had more goal involvements than any other player in the league.
That tells you, isn't it? It's not just the score. He's not just someone who's in the box. He's involved, and his overall play is really impressive, which is what you associate with Harry Kane as well. Harry Kane is not just a striker. He's not just someone who scores loads of goals, which he does, but he does lots of other stuff as well. So Ollie Watkins is getting towards that.
Thomas, when you look at that England squad, Harry Kane, and we've decided Ollie Watkins has to be on that plane as well, do they go with a third striker? Does that mean, if they don't, does that mean Solanke and Ivan Toney are not in that squad for the Euros?
You know, that's a big question, because when you only play with one, you know, and Rashford would normally be in that contention, but I don't think he's done enough, you know, this season to be anywhere near the England squad. So yeah, it's a massive, because as I said, they play with a three. They'll probably load up with wide players instead of going with an extra striker. But it's such a big squad, and I would be surprised if maybe an Ivan Toney or Solanke someone that might offer something totally different, doesn't end up in the squad just in case something happens.
I agree. I think you need a plan B, because the problem is Watkins is almost like a continuation of plan A if you have someone like Ivan Toney in particular, because Dominic Solanke, I think, is a kind of a hybrid version of a Watkins, Kane and Ivan Toney. He's kind of in the middle of that and the way in which he plays. So Ivan Toney is someone that I think would just add a completely different element to that squad if he were involved. And interesting to see, like you mentioned, Marcus Rashford. I don't know. I get the feeling under Gareth and the way that he's had players, he will still pick him if he has a decent run of games between now and the season. Yeah, because he just...
I don't know, man.
I know. I don't think he should either, currently, the way he's playing. But I just feel like if you look at most of his selections, he's continuously sort of stuck with players, even though they haven't necessarily been playing well for their team, their club teams.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, I think there's going to be... so much competition because there's only 23 members of the squad for the Euros, and there's going to be such ridiculous competition, and there's going to be some big players that miss out, and Marcus Rashford might be one of them. And we were talking Jack Grealish as well, what an incredibly talented player, that Cole Palmer, Maddison. There are some really good players that might not be on the plane. So it just shows how strong England are and how competitive it is to get into this squad.
Well, if you think about it, three keepers, three strikers, that leaves you, that's with six players, that leaves you 17 players to pick your midfielders and your defenders with. Still a lot of players,
I mean,
right?
It is. It depends what you're sort of defining as a striker. So if you're saying, you know, Kane, Watkins and Ivan Toney, those are the three. I mean, someone like Marcus Rashford would be kind of like the hybrid between a wide player and a centre forward, which could be useful as well for
versatility, right? That's where you kind of look at it and you go, well, he'll look at players that can double up and play either. So you end up having a player that is maybe not in form, but can play both positions, but will they give you anything if they're not in form? And I think key is form, right? And that surely should be form. And we're talking about, you mentioned it before, Phil, Ollie Watkins, wherever he's been, he's in double figures. So every season after season after season. And we can say now, more recently in the last couple of seasons, that's been in the Premier League. So we can't go back and say, well, yeah, but it was in the lower leagues or on the way up. And he's shown it. He's done it year after year in the Premier League. And his timing of his run is perfect.
Yeah, and he's also, I mean, he has played for England before as well. We're not talking about someone who's got zero international experience. I think he's got 8 or 9 caps. I mean, he has been involved. It wouldn't be a ridiculously left choice, and he wouldn't be making his debut for England. It's someone who's been involved in the setup. He's in the form of his life. At the moment, he's the top scoring English striker in the Premier League. I mean, he's got to be in there.
The WSL was back in action this weekend after the international break. Here's Narelle and Ash to keep you up to date.
Thanks, Schwartzy. Well, no real dramas in terms of the title race. I think it was business as usual for everyone. But the thing that Ash and I really want to talk about were the crowds, Ash, particularly the Emirates.
Yeah.
It's the first time ever that Arsenal have sold out back-to-back WSL matches there, which is not a small achievement by any means. 60,000 people.
Yeah, another 60,000 crowd figure. It's massive, isn't it? And they're sort of leading the charge, not just in England, but across the world, sort of getting consistent crowds to their games. I hear they've got a great travelling contingent these days as well. And what figure were you saying it was, their average crowd numbers gone up this year?
Yeah, it's 35,000 on average, and last season it was 15,000.
And they've sort of already doubled the number of games at the Emirates, which shows that moving the games to the Emirates for them is sort of working really well. And I think, you know, from what I hear about the way they've restructured their marketing team in Arsenal, it's certainly paying dividends. You know, they sort of spread out the resources that were just dedicated to the men's team across the women's team as well. So, you know, really heavily marketed the women's team's games as well. And, you know, they're going to get the rewards in, you know, ticket sales, as well as, you know, we get to see these massive crowds every time they play there.
And you could also make a link between a team like Arsenal, who they're not top of the league, they're not winning trophies left, right and centre, to also the Matildas. They didn't win the World Cup, but every match after that they've played here in Australia have been sold out. And you'd have to think it's because of the marketing and the time they put in behind the scenes and build these players up, and they are actually like superstars now. Yeah. So it's good to see Arsenal doing that.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, how can other teams do that? Because across the rest of the league, the attendances aren't amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're growing, obviously, but they don't. Not as many of them get the opportunity to play at big stadiums. I think, amazingly, Bristol City, right down the bottom, have been getting 5,000-6,000 sort of crowds along. Doesn't look like that many because the stadium's quite big. But, you know, I think other teams will sort of be looking around and saying, well, if Arsenal can do that, we can do that if we put the right investment there. And then it's sort of the build it and they will come sort of motto, I guess. If you start putting the investment there, that return will start coming back and the women's game can sort of hopefully stand on its own 2 feet as a product.
And maybe also something that the men's game could take away from it as well, because the only better crowd attendance that we know of was at Tottenham.
Yeah.
And then it was the WSL.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was... Arsenal have a bigger average attendance for this season than 9 of the Premier League clubs, and that's not playing all of their games at the Emirates.
Did you ever think we'd see the day?
No. Yeah, no. It's amazing. It's so good to see, and you know, hopefully that it's not just Arsenal that are reaping the benefits from this, because it does, you know, it does feed back into the club. The more you can get crowds there, and the environment of the game as a whole.
Couple of busy weeks coming up for some of the teams involved in the knockout competitions, like the FA Cup, which we have here on Optus Sport. Chelsea are taking on Everton. I tell you what, that would really ruin Chelsea's day if they somehow slipped up to Everton.
I think they got their eyes on multiple pieces of silverware this year. So, you know, I think Chelsea certainly heavy favourites heading into that game. I can't see them slipping up. It doesn't strike me as a game that they lose. I don't know what you think.
Mm. I'm also on the fence, but I just know in those matches and in those competitions anything can happen. So I don't think it's a given. Like if they were playing them in the league, you'd think, oh yeah, yeah, easy. But
well, the one game that I'm looking forward to, well, the other game I'm looking forward to in the FA Cup is the Tottenham Man City game, because I think that's where is an upset can occur. Tottenham are dangerous. They've been playing really well, only lost 1-0 to Arsenal. City are going to have to be at their best if they want to, you know, win that game, I think, in the cup.
And then when the WSL does return, would you have a look at that? Chelsea are hosting Arsenal, and that's at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah.
Do we think that will be a sellout? And do we think Schwartzy is going to attend?
Schwartzy's going to have a full suite of people up there in his box. But yeah, look at that. Nice game to come back to for the WSL. And you know, it'll be really interesting to see what crowd figures they get there. It'll be interesting to see whether Chelsea, you know, off the back of, they're the most successful team in England. They should be getting massive crowds, I think. Alongside Arsenal, who haven't won something in a little while.
Mm-hmm. Well, Schwartzy, we expect to see you there.
I would love to be at the game, Chelsea against Arsenal, but unfortunately I've got a pre-engagement. I will be up in Yorkshire at a 60th birthday party. So I will be watching from afar. This is an Arsenal side, I said it right at the beginning of the season, one of the, if not the best squads in the league. They just haven't sort of shown it regularly throughout the course of the season. They ground out a result on the weekend against Tottenham. Wasn't particularly their best performance, but I think that's kind of been the case with Arsenal throughout the course of the season. But they're going to have to play well against Chelsea, who showed against Leicester on the weekend just gone that even when they don't play that well, they can still produce. And with the injuries they've got, they've still got enough strength in depth. And with some couple of players coming back, they are still formidable. So it's going to be a mouthwatering fixture and I can't wait for it. Phil, what time is it?
It's 11:07 in Spain at the moment.
No, Phil, it's La Liga time, silly. Come on.
Oh,
come with the right. Get up to speed, buddy. Valencia, sorry, Real Madrid.
Yes.
Yeah, where do we start? Where do we start on this game, Phil?
Well, I'll give you the briefest overview that I can possibly do. It finished 2-2. Valencia were 2-0 up against Real Madrid. Real Madrid then got a goal back right on the stroke of half-time, scored by Vinicius Jr. All eyes were him after the racist abuse that he had suffered at the same stadium last season. He celebrated scoring that first goal by lifting a clenched fist above his head and standing there in front of the stand where he had been racially abused last season. It was a very powerful image. Then in the second half, Real Madrid looking for an equaliser, and it doesn't come. We head into injury time and a penalty is given to Valencia to make it 3-1. The referee sees that a foul is given and we're talking 90 minutes and 20 seconds. Remember that figure, 90 minutes and 20 seconds when the penalty is given. And the referee is then... All right, 90. And then the referee is then told to go and have a look at it by the VAR. And it's clearly not a penalty. I mean, it's definitely not a penalty. And then he makes a decision. No penalty is given. 2 minutes is taken over that decision. So we're talking about 92-21, I think, when play starts again. So 2 minutes is taken. 7 minutes have been added to injury time at the end of the 90 minutes. So we're supposed to go to 97, right? But the referee says we're going to play an extra minute because of the VAR review. But there was 2 minutes there. The ref made a mistake. But anyway, we'll continue. We get to 98 minutes and a corner is given to Real Madrid. The referee says you're going to get the corner and nothing else. It's just the corner and nothing else. Take it quickly. The ball is played in by Luka Modric. It's clear to the edge of the area and the referee should blow his whistle there. But he doesn't. He takes another 2 or 3 or 4 seconds to blow the whistle. And by the time he's blown the whistle, Brahim Diaz has floated a ball into the box. Jude Bellingham is headed home, a 99th minute winner for Real Madrid. But the final whistle has been blown. And it was blown just before or just as Brahim Diaz was playing the ball into the box. And quite simply, guys, all hell breaks loose on the pitch. You know that emotions run high in football. Emotions run very, very high in Spanish football. And the referee was surrounded by Real Madrid players. They could not believe that he had chosen that moment to blow the final whistle. How can you do it? Jude Bellingham is sent off in the aftermath for telling the referee repeatedly, it's an effing goal, it's an effing goal. The referee didn't take kindly to those words and showed him a straight red card. Carlo Ancelotti comes across to speak to the referee. There's a huge melee. But in the end, he had blown his whistle. He made a big mistake. He should not have blown it then. And actually, if you're going to take it further back, either you don't let the corner be taken, which he shouldn't have, because he should have, if he was only going to add 1 minute, then it's 98. Don't let the corner be taken. Or add 2 minutes extra because you were watching the VAR replay for 2 minutes. So it should have been up to 99. A catastrophic performance from the referee, a catalogue of errors. And it all ended up with Real Madrid feeling very, very put out and feeling like there was a great injustice against them. Didn't really matter because Barcelona drew a Girona loss. So they're still clear at the top of the table. But yeah, it was a big, big ending to the game.
What did you think though, Phil? When it happened, what did you actually think as the referee blew the whistle and the ball came into the box? What were your initial thoughts? And how do you feel about it right now?
My initial thoughts were that he's blown the whistle. So I heard the whistle. We all heard the whistle blow just before or just as the ball was coming into the box. So when the header came in from Jude Bellingham, I knew it wasn't going to count because we'd all heard the final whistle. I just thought, it's ridiculous to blow the whistle then. But it's a really difficult job being a referee. It's a very well-paid job in Spain, by the way. They're the best-paid refs, certainly in Europe, maybe even the world. But it's a really difficult job, and he made a mistake by 2 or 3 seconds. These are the fine, fine margins of whether you do something right or you do something wrong. And he should have blown it 3 or 4 seconds earlier, and we wouldn't have been talking about this. But he didn't. Having said that, you know, there were a lot of things that he could have done better in this whole build-up. And it got me thinking, I don't think the full-time whistle should be down to someone's opinion. I think we can get rid of all of these arguments by having a stop clock in injury time. Now, I know people have said we should stop the clock during the 90 minutes and then we'll get rid of time wasting. But I don't necessarily like that idea because I think it breaks up the flow of the game. But in injury time, we need to know when the game finishes. It can't just be down to someone's interpretation. It can't just be down to someone's opinion. So if there's 7 minutes, you have 7 minutes. The ball stops when there's a stoppage. And then when it gets to 7 minutes, it's up. It's not up for debate. I think that that's something quite simple that can be implemented to avoid any of this, because I just think it's important, so important, that we know when the match is finished. I don't think it can be a matter of judgment or opinion. I don't know what you guys think about this as former pros.
Thomas, so are you going in the American style? Stop the clock. Stop the clock. Play goes down straight away. Right, stop. Or what do you think?
You know what? You know, I think the sangria must be very strong in Madrid at the moment.
It's 11:07 in the morning, mate. I'm not on the sangria.
Hey, I don't know your routine. But it's
he's not on the sangria just yet. He's on the cerveza. So he's had a couple of cervezas now. And the sangria comes in about 2 or 3 hours' time, actually 4 hours' time when he sits down for lunch.
I take it Thomas doesn't agree.
No, I definitely don't agree. I watch a lot of American sport and I'm dead sick of all that, you know, stop, start. And you know, I quite like that there's room for interpretation. And I think in my book, the referee is clear enough. You know, we shouldn't sit here and Madrid shouldn't complain about 2 or 3 seconds. Like that's, you know, he still blows the whistle before anything else happens. And then I've also heard the argument of, but then, you know, it's the sequence. Yeah, but when does the sequence, like, so if they clear it the second time, do you then wait for the third cross or the fourth cross or the sixth cross? You know, where does that sequence end? And I think in my book, he made it clear at the end of that corner, it would be end of the game before anything else happens. Then I don't really care about the 2 or 3 seconds, you know, because that was it. And, you know, yeah. And I definitely don't want a stop clock, you know, so.
Brutal rejection from Torres Torres.
Yes.
Idea kicked out into the bin. Schwartzy, you're going to do the same?
So first and foremost, on the decision from the referee, the sequence of events, the way that the corner's obviously been given, he's indicated this is the last action. Ball comes in, goes to the edge of the box. As the ball goes out to the right-hand side of the box, referee turns away and puts the whistle to his mouth. he blows his whistle. And as he blows his whistle, then he turns and looks and glances and see the ball goes in and then just goes, no, I've blown the whistle. So I understand from a player's perspective how frustrated Real Madrid players were, but I think the referee's fine and well within his right to do what he's done. He's allowed the corner to take place. It's kind of the ball's come out and it's gone to the side and he's allowed it still to go. I don't think the referee got that necessarily wrong. I think that's fair enough. The behavior was another thing. I mean, you can talk all day long about the reaction. I get the emotions are running high, but that can't continuously happen. That's what annoys me about some elements of football, just the overreaction, the carry on. But anyway, so it's a very emotional game, as we all know. I'm on the fence about the stop clock thing, right? Because I've got to try and take it out of my head that it's an American thing, right? Just because it's an American thing that's predominantly used in American sports doesn't mean it's a bad thing, right? We can take good things and bad things with different sports. Something needs to change in football because the amount of time that is wasted and teams, Thomas, we know it, we will waste time. Yeah. We will waste time as much as we can.
Especially you goalkeepers.
Absolutely. And if the ball's in play, you can do it to a degree, right? And then once you pick it up, you've got 6 seconds, nine, and that's the referee's job then to regulate. And often the referees just allow goalkeepers to have the ball for so long. However, the actual added time on playing 10 minutes, 11 minutes, 12 minutes, I don't think is the way forward. I think they should trial that whole stop clock thing. Free kick, referee blows his whistle. The minute referee blows his whistle, the clock stops until the ball plays in again. I think we can trial it and see how it goes. Then you're going to get a genuine 90 minutes of ball in play. Because even with the added time on, right, even each time when there's 9 minutes, 10 minutes of added time, in those 9, 10 minutes, there's wasted time.
I mean, if you do that for a 90-minute game, the games are going to last 4 hours if you stop it every time. they're going to last a lot longer.
I think it's going to change, right? I think that teams will realize that no amount of wasting time, yes, we'll get a breather and we're able to reset, but it's still going to be 90 minutes regardless. We're not going to be able to eat into that 90 minutes.
Yeah, but I think that was talked about earlier, like some years ago, where they were saying, no, let's play 60 minutes and then have, but that's, with a stop clock. Because that's like, when you look at the stats, that's more or less 50, 60 minutes, how much the ball is actually in play for a game. So maybe that can be trialed, but I think 90 minutes, then it's a whole afternoon. Yeah.
I'm not sure about 50, 60 minutes. It just seems too short. It does. I know what you're saying.
But if you look at actual times of like ball in play times during games, it's not much more than that.
What's the response in Madrid now, Phil, after the referee's decision?
Everyone's sort of taking it really sort of calmly, lying down. You know,
but you talk about Real Madrid TV, right? Are they going to go to town on this guy now?
I think we might hear more about this between now and the end of the season and for every other season and until the end of time. Like I said, this is a country and a way of viewing football that loves polemic stuff. And this kind of thing is latched upon by all elements of the media to try and prove one thing or the other, which is a little bit boring if you have to deal with it every day. But it can also be mildly amusing if you're looking at it from a distance. So, yeah, Real Madrid are deeply, deeply, deeply unhappy. And they are using this as some kind of evidence that there is deep-rooted conspiracy against them, which is somewhat difficult to swallow. But, you know, like we've said previously on the podcast, people believe whatever they want to believe. So if people want to believe that, they will, despite any evidence to the contrary. But yeah, it was a big thing. And listen, we're here talking about it now, and it was a controversial incident, and it's worthy of discussion and mention. But I don't think we need to go much deeper into it, because it was just a mistake from the referee that can happen.
Yeah, I don't necessarily believe that the referees or is a conspiracy theory against Real Madrid or Barcelona for that matter, because they keep winning things a year after year, really, don't they? So it's kind of like, if there is, they're clearly not doing it well enough. They're clearly not biased enough, because they keep winning too many things, right? Let's be honest. Talk about one of those teams, Barcelona against Athletic Club Bilbao. Tough place to go to in Bilbao. 0-0. But it's not a result, really, that Barcelona will be happy with, and pretty much rules them out of the title hunt, right, Phil?
Yeah, pretty much after Real Madrid had dropped these points in the controversial circumstances, it was a massive opportunity for Barcelona to get themselves back into the title race. Had they won in Bilbao, they would have been only 6 points behind Real Madrid. And, you know, it's still 6 points, but it's a chance. But yeah, 8 points feels like it's too much for them. And it was a really poor performance. Xavi actually came out and said it was a really poor performance.
No,
which
he didn't.
Tend to
he
do.
Couldn't have.
I know, right?
No,
I know.
He must have, no, I don't believe you. Where's the recording?
I know. I could get it out. It was surprising, but he was very, very honest. And it was not the kind of performance that they needed to get back into the title race. The big, big news for them is that they lost Pedri and Frenkie de Jong through injury. And it's massive, massive blow, particularly with Champions League coming up against Napoli in 8 days' time. And Pedri, man, just another injury for him. It was a muscular problem as well. He went down on his own in tears on the substitutes bench. And it's just beginning to get quite worrying now because he's such an extraordinarily talented player and he has been so blighted by injuries the last couple of seasons and his development is being stunted. He's not getting enough games in a row and it's a massive, massive blow for him and Barcelona. So yeah, but I think this definitely rules them out of the title race. And they're not even second now. They're still behind Girona as well. So let's see if they can finish second.
Mallorca did one over Girona. Hashtag yeah. Always watch Girona. They didn't score again, Phil.
Yeah, okay. We can get rid of that hashtag now. It was fun while it lasted. But the dream of Girona winning the league title against all odds is, I think, over now. Girona losing to Mallorca for the second time this season in... they lost to them in the Copa del Rey a couple of weeks ago and they lost to them again. They're 7 points behind Real Madrid. They're just running out of steam, basically. And they looked a little bit tired. They lacked spark in the final third, which is something they've had in abundance this season. And yeah, they're not going to win the league. They are going to focus now on trying to finish in the top four, which would still be a monumental achievement. They're 9 points clear of fifth. They should still do it, but it's three defeats in the last four now for Girona. So they're not in good form.
I mean, talk about big games, right? In Spain, Valencia, Real Madrid was pretty big. Barcelona, yeah, obviously these teams are pretty big, but there's really no other bigger fixture than the Kitramilidis-Schwarza derby, right? It's Rayo Vallecano against Cádiz. There's no bigger fixture than that one, right?
There is, there's no bigger fixure than Rayo against Cádiz.
Thanks for building up there, Phil. Thanks for pumping it up and thanks for helping me out there, mate. I mean, I know the game is pretty crap, right? Oh. But you didn't watch it, Thomas. See, you didn't know about the derby, that's why.
No.
Yeah, I'm just remembering how bad a game it was. I mean, it was a really low quality game, really, really low quality. It finished 1-1. But you know, the nice thing about this game, actually, it is actually a unique fixture, I think, in Spain and maybe across the world as well, because these two sets of supporters absolutely love each other. And that's why, you know, me and Schwartz get on so well, because he's Cadiz, I'm Rayo. And there is a bond between these two clubs, which is actually quite unique. Like, I was at the stadium at the weekend and there were loads of people with Cadiz shirts on and Rayo Vallecano scarves. They're bonded by a similar kind of political outlook. A lot of the fans, they like being the underdogs. They fight against adversity. They're really sort of socially aware. And these two clubs genuinely love each other. There's an incredible bond. The Cadiz fans took out a big banner in support of the Rayo fans who don't want to move stadium. There's an amazing, amazing atmosphere and relationship between these two sets of supporters, which is genuinely unique and quite special and nice to watch. Certainly nicer to watch than the actual game, which was really, truly abysmal. But yeah, I think it's a unique fixture. And there we go, Schwartz. You know, the Kitra-Schwartz derby is it's actually a beautiful thing, man.
Thank you, mate. That's very nice of you. I mean, you redeemed yourself in the end because you weren't giving me any love whatsoever to begin with. Thomas, do you have a team that you support? And don't tell me Real Madrid or Barcelona, right? Because that doesn't count.
Okay. Yeah, it does. You can support them if you want. Yeah,
no,
you can.
No,
there's millions of people support them all over the world. It's fine.
That's why you can't. No,
I'm going to go against you here, Schwartz, because I do have a soft spot for Barcelona because it just goes back to... No, but back in the early 90s, when they won, I think it was like four championships in a row with Romario, Stoichkov. You know, those are the games I...
Johan Cruyff as a manager,
Yeah, and Michael Laudrup had the Danish interest in the team as well. I think that was sort of some of the first games I remember watching every week. I just wanted to watch because it was so exciting, you know, the skill and Like, I love Romario, the way he played. So I think, you know, I probably lean towards it, but I don't have a, you know, I don't have a sort of a, I don't have a scarf like you guys.
Yeah, you know, Michael Laudrup also played for Real Madrid.
I know, but I'll forget about it.
he's got this incredible record, Michael Laudrup. He's the only player to play in the Clásico in two successive seasons for both different teams and to win 5-0 in both seasons. So no first way. Season he played for Barcelona and won 5-0, and the second season he played for Real Madrid.
There's not many players that have played for all three, as in Barcelona, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, right? Bernd Schuster was one of them, the German.
Yeah. Bernd Schuster played for Barcelona, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid. And he was a terrific, terrific player as well. But yeah, I mean, I could talk a lot about Michael Laudrup, by the way, because he was such a tremendous, tremendous player. And there's this great story. Laudrup was discussing leaving Spain in a restaurant, and the King Juan Carlos was in the same restaurant, and he appeared at his shoulder, and he'd been sitting a few tables away, and he came over and he said, you're leaving. He said, that's good news. I'll be the only king in Madrid again. That's how much he was loved in Madrid, Michael Laudrup. So yeah, a tremendous, what, maybe the best Danish player ever, Thomas. You know,
he was crowned that about 3 or 4 years ago. So player of the century. So yeah.
Right, guys, that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you again, Phil and Thomas, for joining us. As always, remember to watch every game of the Premier League, La Liga, the WSL and the J League live and exclusive on Optus Sport. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.